From the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, you're listening to Earth First Radio. Stay tuned for No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music.
You're cutting chainsaws, killing the trees, something everything that lives in peace. Our animal friends are on the run, but there's nowhere to go when the job is done. Takes place. We've got to stop this inhuman race.
Welcome to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and each week I bring you No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music for activists on the front lines of the environmental movement. In the news, you'll hear about corporations, government agencies, and people who are killing the planet, and about the folks who have the detailed information about saving what's left. They all have names, addresses, phone numbers, fax numbers, email, or web addresses, so please get a pencil or a pen and some recycled paper to write down the information you're about to hear. Because this isn't Couch Potato Radio, it's Activist Radio, and I'm asking you to take down the information and act on it. You really can make a difference by writing letters, sending faxes, and making phone calls when you aren't out in the woods up in a tripod or tree sit, or locked down in the Dragon at the road blockade. If you have information, news, comments, or announcements for Earth First Radio, please keep that pencil or pen handy and listen for the contact information in the last half of the show. Let's get into news here, and our first action news story comes from India. Indians affected by Man Project protest in India. Hundreds of Indian people, farmers and peasants, took to the streets of Dahar, India, protesting the arrest of people affected by the Man Dam Project on the 21st of March from the Man Project site. The rally passed through the main streets of the city, ending at the collector's office, where they submitted a memorandum for the Chief Minister Shri Javed Singh. Besides those affected by the Man Project, hundreds affected by the Maheshwar and Sarovar projects were also part of the rally. Those are other dam projects in India. Representatives from the Adivasi Mukti Sangathan and respected citizens from Indore also expressed their solidarity with the displaced people by being part of the rally. In the memorandum to the chief minister, the project-affected people have demanded the immediate unconditional release of those arrested on the 21st of this month, stopping the construction of the dam immediately, and undertaking the rehabilitation processes as stated in the Narmada Water Disputes Tribunal Award and the government orders. The people have warned that if this is not done, they will intensify their struggle. The Man Project is one of 30 large dams envisaged by the Narmada Valley Development Project. The 17 Adivasi villages are going to be affected by this project. 993 families will be affected this year if the construction of the dam continues. In other words, about 5,000 to 6,000 people are slated for displacement with all their legal rights violated and no rehabilitation provided. In spite of the clear provision for providing agricultural land in exchange, the government has failed to comply and ignored their rehabilitation rights. As of the 21st of this month, that's March, hundreds of people affected by the Man Project in Dahar District stormed and occupied the dam site, stopping any further construction of the dam. The affected families have declared that until the state government completely rehabilitates all the affected families by allotting them cultivable land, agricultural land as per the policy, work on the dam will not be permitted. 213 of them were arrested and held for more than 6 days in Dahar jail. Protesting the callous attitude of the government, hundreds of Man Project affected Indian people, along with those affected by other projects in the Narmada Valley, demonstrated on the streets, expressing their anger and disgust. They demanded the government immediately release those arrested and complete all rehabilitation before venturing to construct the dam. Everyone present warned the government that if these demands are not met, then struggle will be intensified at the state and national level. And I want to thank the A-Infos News Service for that article. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign update for this week. The Buffalo Field Campaign Week of Action has come off wonderfully. Over 50 people came up to the field camp to help out. New volunteers learned in the field and in workshops that were held. 11 volunteers have been arrested since March 14th, and we are thankful that they are all now free. Thursday morning, 4 of the bulls that were captured were released at Duck Creek and promptly walked about 2 miles back up the creek into the park. 3 others were sent to slaughter. Thanks to all for the concern shown for our intrepid tripod sitter last week. He was uninjured in the event, and medication to control the bruising in his wrist has been effective. This was a demonstrator who went up in a platform in a tripod, and the police and Department of Livestock officials cut the platform out from under him, and he hung by his wrists for a while. Apparently, he's a hemophiliac, and some wonder why a hemophiliac would put himself in such a position. His love for the bison and the wild lands that they need is the answer. Modern medicine does have its benefits, and this volunteer leads a more active life than most. His blockade of the 610 road kept 3 bison out of the capture facility and safe for now. Last Friday afternoon, over 30 people adorned in costumes rallied at the Forest Service office in West Yellowstone. Bald eagles, trumpeter swans, ducks, wolves, and bison sought their complaints to the Forest Service officials who were charged with their protection. While the wildlife were denied entrance to the office, 2 people held a short discussion about the bison situation with District Ranger Stan Bennis. Stan listened to their concerns but claimed that he had no power to end the slaughter or the disruption of this critical wildlife habitat. A similar march, including the animal species costumes, was held in town on Saturday. Wildlife from the area paraded through the streets and out to the park entrance, talking with tourists and townsfolk on the way. Although we had planned a more direct approach for that day, with all the recent arrests, this was a fitting action. Last Sunday, the Enemami Sundance Church held a ceremony for the buffalo on the Madison River Bluffs. About 40 people gathered in prayer for the Buffalo Nation. It was a beautiful end to a truly crazy week, and much-needed storm began to drop snow and rain after the ceremony. Many thanks to all who helped make the week of action a success. And that's the Buffalo Field Campaign update for last week. Please go to www.wildrockies.org/buffalo for more information. And the College of the Atlantic demands forest-friendly products in response to requests by student conservationists. College of the Atlantic of Bar Harbor, Maine, announced it would switch to 100% recycled, old-growth-free, chlorine-free, forest-friendly paper products, reports the Bangor Daily News. College of the Atlantic also pledged to use salvaged, recycled, and non-wood building materials before buying new lumber for campus construction. The Student Environmental Action Coalition helped convince the school administration to support sustainable building materials in addition to paper supplies and has launched a campus-wide boycott of Boise Cascade for logging its old-growth forests, and we'll have more news about Boise Cascade later on in the show. Quote, being a green college is important to the students, said Lynn Bernizes, purchasing agent for the college. We're trying to do this for a better world. The College of the Atlantic joins the University of North Carolina, the University of Vermont, many big businesses and city governments who have banned the use of products from endangered or old-growth forests. We wish to thank those institutions for their leadership and encourage students around the world to join the Tree Free Campus campaign to cancel contracts with Boise Cascade. For more information, contact Ann Martin, Field Director for American Lands. Her number is 775-786-1658. That's 775-786-1658. Or send mail to annem@americanlands.org. Moving to Oregon, concerned Oregon State University students and alumni destroyed genetically engineered trees at Oregon State University. In mid-March, concerned OSU students and alumni targeted 3 genetically engineered test sites where poplar and cottonwood trees are being grown by Steve Strauss, a forestry professor at Oregon State University and founder of the Tree Genetic Engineering Research Cooperative. According to the communique, the test plots at these places were independently assessed and found to be a dangerous experiment of unknown genetic consequences. The communique continues, we ring-barked or cut down 90% of your trees at OSU's site at the PV Arboretum on Arboretum Road, and that's off Highway 99 West north of Corvallis, Oregon, at OSU's track near Half Moon Bend on the Willamette River just south of Garden Avenue off Highway 20. between Corvallis and Albany. We eliminated 60% of the trees. Lastly, every tree was cut down in one test plot of OSU's Agricultural Experiment Station in Klamath Falls, Oregon, and that's on Washburn Way across from Kingsley Field. In all, over 1,200 of your genetically engineered research trees were destroyed. Oregon State University is the number one university in the world for genetically engineered tree research. Among other studies, OSU experiments with engineering Monsanto's Roundup Ready herbicide into the cells of poplar trees. This action by the OSU students comes just weeks after the Earth Liberation Front burned a research cotton gin in Visalia, California. Since November 1998, there have been over 40 antigenetic direct actions in North America. The direct actionists maintain that biotechnology is completely unnecessary and is being developed at the expense of human and ecological health solely for to increase the profits of large multinational corporations. With the North American growing season at hand, it is likely the direct actions against facilities producing and testing genetically engineered organisms will resume. Concerning the questions about hybrids in general, the mass replacement of native forests with ecologically unstable monocultural hybrid tree farms is a gamble with terrifying consequences. The only selection traits for what to breed into these hybrids are economical ones, so therefore the non-genetically engineered hybrid tree farms are an ecological threat, and in the case of TGERC especially, are a legitimate target on their own. And we thank Genetics Alert for that message. Moving to Boise, Idaho, on the eve of controversial hearings for legal challenges to the U.S. roadless policy, two forest activists rappelled from the Jefferson Building at 350 North 9th Street in Boise, Idaho, to deliver a forceful message to America's old-growth logging giant. Directly in front of Boise Cascade's headquarters, the massive 60-by-30-foot banner read, "Boise Cascade, an American Disgrace." Boise Cascade is the lead plaintiff in a suit designed to prevent some of the country's largest remaining wilderness areas from being protected. And, by the way, the judge threw that suit out. "Shame on Boise Cascade," said Michael Brune, campaigns director for Rainforest Action Network. 95% of our country's old-growth forests have already been destroyed, yet Boise Cascade continues to have its hand out, demanding access to the few pockets of wilderness that remain. It's disgraceful that the company still hasn't learned from the mistakes of its past. Just as our society has moved beyond such outdated practices as slaughtering elephants for ivory, we now seem to be on the verge of ending old-growth logging as we know it, declared Jennifer Krill, one of the climbers from that demonstration. It's time for industry dinosaurs like Boise Cascade to meet these new standards in the marketplace and to get out of old-growth forests once and for all. RAND has launched a markets campaign targeting the top 500 customers of Boise Cascade, urging each company to discontinue business relations with the company. Boise Cascade's practices run counter to the purchasing policies of many of its top customers, such as Home Depot, Kinko's, Lowe's, and others. If you want more information, contact Shannon, media and communications person for Rainforest Action Network. Her number, 415-398-4404. That's 415-398-4404. Or you can always go to www.ran.org. And in Sea Shepherd International news, the Sirenian intercepts a Costa Rican longliner northwest of Wolf Island in the Galapagos. At sunset on March 22nd on its second patrol in the Galapagos Marine Reserve, the Sea Shepherd patrol boat Sirenian intercepted a Costa Rican longliner just 20 miles northwest of Wolf Island. "We were en route to Wolf Island on our third day out when a target appeared on radar due west of us. We knew we had a ship on radar and decided to change course and intercept. We reached a visible range at approximately 6 miles and confirmed at a mile the Punta Arenas registry on the stern. We had caught the Canela II out of Punta Arenas, Costa Rica, violating the Marine Reserve. The Canela II had decided to flee, and we were quickly in pursuit. It did not take long for the Sirenian to catch up with her, and we ordered her to stop all engines. On close approach, the Canela II finally complied. We lowered the Zodiac and proceeded to board the vessel. We advised the captain that he was in violation of the special law for Galapagos and that we were going to inspect his vessel. I noticed the wire hooks and knew that she was involved in shark finning. The question was, did she have any on board? On inspection, we discovered freshly caught sharks in two of her cargo holds, not yet frozen. I visually confirmed more than 40 sharks. We also found two bags full of shark fins. Her entire cargo was sharks, with the exception of two marlin. On interrogation, the captain advised us that he also had his long lines down and they were at a location inside the Marine Reserve. We had approximately 25 miles of long line all within the reserve. We started picking up that line at 9 of that evening and did not finish until 1 in the morning. I counted approximately 10 sharks on the line. We attempted to unhook the line from the first one, but quickly found out that it was impossible without doing further harm to the shark. It was wrenching to watch and was extremely hard to continue filming. We were left with only one choice, cut the line and free the shark, as we instructed to do for all the sharks caught on the line. We are escorting the Canela 2 to Puerto Ayora for charges. It is going to be a voyage of approximately 24 hours cruising since the Canela 2 can run no faster than 6 knots. And this report by Sean O'Hearn, the Sea Shepherd Marine Liaison Officer from the Galapagos Islands. If you'd like to contact the Sea Shepherd International, they are at P.O. Box 2616, Friday Harbor, Washington, 98250. That's P.O. Box 2616. Friday Harbor, Washington, 98250, or you can give them a call at 360-370-5500, and of course, www.seashepherd.org is where they are on the net. And once again this week, we have some bad news. Greenpeace International founder dies in car crash. One of the most influential figures in the environmental movement, the man widely credited with the first campaign to save whales and to end French nuclear testing, David McTaggart died in a head-on car crash near his home in Umbria, Italy, last week. When news reached Greenpeace International headquarters in Amsterdam, tributes were quick to follow from leaders of the group he helped to found. Quote, "We are all deeply shocked by this news," said Interim International Executive Director Gerd Leopold. "Greenpeace would not be what it is today without his amazing force behind it. Greenpeace would be unthinkable without his force of personality. He built up the organization into the international pressure group it is today, opening offices in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe when no one believed it was possible. Not only is he a great loss to Greenpeace, but also to the environmental movement worldwide," added Leopold. "David had an amazing life. He shook the world," said Peter Tabbins, executive director of Greenpeace Canada. "He fought to protect all of us from the nuclear threat. No one did more." In a testimonial to McTaggart, Greenpeace described the 68-year-old as relentless, controversial, and a thorn in the side of entire governments and corporations. "He bears sole credit for unifying a group of internally warring hippies into an international environmental force, and the lion's share of the credit for Greenpeace's successful campaigns to preserve Antarctica from oil exploration and to halt commercial whaling," it continued. "He stood as a living example of the difference an individual can make, from his defiance of nuclear weapons blasts from the deck of his tiny and beloved sailing ship Vega, to his steadfast refusal to accept that any odds were too great or that any challenge was too big. He had the guts to make saving the planet his personal mission, the charisma to inspire others to that task, and the strategic savvy to make you think he might just pull it off. The world will never see another one of him." Born in Vancouver, Canada in 1932, McTaggart ran a successful construction business for 20 years before sailing into a new life of environmental action that began in the South Pacific in 1971. So outraged was McTaggart at the French government's decision to cordon off international waters in order to conduct nuclear testing, he renamed his 12.5-meter sailing craft Greenpeace III and sailed into the zone surrounding Mururoa Atoll. Dropping anchor downwind from the planned blast, McTaggart forced the French government to halt its test. A French Navy vessel rammed Greenpeace III, but McTaggart repaired his boat and returned a year later. On that occasion, he was beaten by French military personnel, with the incident captured on camera by a crewmate. The photos helped McTaggart win part of a lengthy court case against the French in 1974, the same year the French government announced it would end its atmospheric nuclear testing program. In 1977, McTaggart began organizing support throughout Europe for Greenpeace, by then established in more than a dozen countries. In 1979, he united factions of the organization under his chairmanship as Greenpeace International. Between 1975 and 1991, McTaggart led Greenpeace campaigns to save the whales, stop the dumping of nuclear waste in the ocean, block the production of toxic waste, end nuclear testing, and protect the Antarctic continent from oil and mineral exploitation. He published numerous articles and two books. Awards for his contributions to environmentalism worldwide included the Onassis Award, the Kresge Prize, and the United Nations Environmental Program's Global 500 Award. In September 1991, McTaggart retired from active chairmanship of Greenpeace International to a farm in Italy, where he raised organic olive oil and continued to work on whaling and other issues through his own foundation. He pushed the organization hard, and the organization pushed back hard, said Greenpeace International statement. Some of his closest colleagues will still describe him as a cold-hearted bastard, and when David retired from active leadership in the organization in 1991, there were those who breathed a sigh of relief. Many believed the organization had outgrown his leadership and that the skills of a ragtag pirate leader were simply no longer a match to an organization that had grown so large so fast. But one thing Greenpeace will never outgrow was David's extraordinary spirit. I want to thank Environment News Service for this news article. David McTaggart, founder of Greenpeace, dead. Truly a bummer. Moving to some better news. Without a deal, Tree Setter says she won't budge. It was a frigid first weekend 50 feet above the ground for Tracy Dolphin McNeely as she sat in the branches of an oak tree in Brown's Woods in Bloomington, Indiana, to protect the area from development. But as temperatures dipped into the teens and snow flurries whipped across her wood and tarp shelter on high, McNeely said she still plans on staying in the tree for as long as it takes to halt plans to place a 208-unit apartment complex on the west side property. Snow was not on the menu when I started this, McNeely said, but the community support so far has been wonderful. I've been getting tons of help from people on the ground. The tree sit, which began Thursday morning, was organized by Buffalo Trace Earth First, a local environmental group in Bloomington, Indiana. According to Earth First, the tree sit is the first of its kind east of the Mississippi. Since taking her roost, McNeely said she's been kept busy reading and greeting a near constant stream of visitors and well-wishers. I keep busy just saying hi to all the people who come by, a lot of people from the apartment complex next door and friends, she said. I'm busier now than I ever was before. One supporter even had a pizza delivered to McNeely last Saturday night. It's probably the first time Avers has ever had a call to deliver a pizza to a tree, the delivery person said. So far, property owner Bill Brown and Indianapolis-based developer Herman and Associates, who plan on beginning construction early this summer, according to Vice President Jeff Kittle, have no interaction with the tree sitter. Likewise, Bloomington police, receiving no complaints thus far, have had no involvement, according to Sergeant Bob Neely. Meanwhile, the 19-year-old activist sits in her well-stocked treehouse with boxes of soy milk and organic pasta, trying to stay warm and looking forward to the possible visit from Julia Butterfly this week. The woods where the tree sit is about 50 acres and sits between 2nd and 3rd Streets just north of the Basswood apartment complex and adjacent to Indiana Route 37 and the Twin Lakes softball diamonds. If you're looking for that area, go out there and give Tracy some support out there, okay? And, of course, I want to thank Jason Nicky of the Bloomington Herald-Times for that story. Coming up is the National Day of Action Against State Repression in support of Frank Ambrose, and that's taking place on Thursday, April 5th, an open call for militant direct action targeting FBI offices and U.S. federal buildings. On Thursday, April 5th, Frank Ambrose has his pretrial date in Bloomington, Indiana for allegedly tree spiking in association with the Earth Liberation Front. Frank was the first person arrested in North America who has been officially charged with an ELF action. He maintains his innocence and feels the FBI and state authorities are framing him for the action just to get a conviction related to the underground ELF. The ELF, an international direct action group using economic sabotage to protect the natural environment, has caused nearly $40 million of damages since 1997 when North America alone to entities profiting off the destruction of life. The FBI and other local, state, federal policing agencies are under growing pressure to stop the successful work of the ELF, and repression from these authorities is respectively growing nationwide. It is up to us to resist this repression by any means necessary. On April 5th, voice and demonstrate your anger against state repression in support of Frank and the courageous members of the ELF, whoever they may be. Take part in organized militant direct action demonstrations targeting FBI offices and U.S. federal buildings. Those who are organizing legal demonstrations are asked to contact the North American Earth Liberation Front press office with times, contact persons, and locations for media purposes. Get involved now. Take direct action. For more information, contact the North American ELF press office. Their number, 503-478-0902. That's 503-478-0902. Or you can send email to ELF Press at tao.ca. And, of course, their webpage, www.earthliberationfront.com. Also coming up very shortly is the Cascadia Activism and Ecology Conference in Olympia, Washington, April 5th through 8th, sponsored by the Environmental Resource Center and other student groups at Evergreen State College. The conference will create a forum for environmental scientists, activists, and community members to network for the development of forest protection campaigns in the Cascadia bioregion. For more information, contact Shoren Brown at the Environmental Resources Center. That's 360-866-6000, extension 6784. That number again, 360-866-6000, extension 6784, or send email to Shoren Brown, that's S-H-O-R-E-N-B-R-O-W-N, at yahoo.com. And we're going to take a little musical break here and listen to the Just Kidding Band out of Santa Cruz, and this one's called Yuppie on the Mountain.
Somewhere where the life is wild and trees embrace the sky, coyotes howl to the moon as she slowly traces by. Far from the concrete in the hills of frost and snow, life weaves its web as the lights burn on below. But there's a yuppie on the mountain from the land of corporate greed, buying, selling parasites, filling a consuming need, filling that consuming need. Yeah, there's a yuppie on the mountain. Everybody run, thinks it's a game of Monopoly, won't stop till he's won, won't stop till he's won. And the wheels will roll, here to sell my soul. Pray someday they'll sell it back to me. Yeah, the time will come when it's all been done. With the world to gain, what have we done? What have we won? 'Cause there's a yuppie on the mountain from the land of corporate greed, buying, selling parasites, filling a consuming need, filling that consuming need. Yeah, there's a yuppie on the mountain. Everybody run, thinks to gain the Monopoly, won't stop till he's won, won't stop till he's won.
And that's the conclusion of our first half of Earth First Radio. Stay tuned for more news coming right up.